Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we discuss the humanitarian crisis facing Armenians living in the Nagorno-Karabakh region of Azerbaijan. And we talk to journalist and author Farai Chidea about her new podcast, Our Body Politic. But first, this week, Governor Gavin Newsom announced California was putting the emergency brake on its reopening plan due to the state's rising COVID-19 numbers. Most counties are now in the most restrictive purple tier. FM89's Madi Bolaños went to Firebaugh to get the reaction of this small Fresno County farming town that has fought hard to keep cases low.
Not every small town in the valley has a COVID-19 code enforcement officer, but Firebaugh does. His name is Surf Gonzalez, and thanks to Newsom's recent order, he's dropping by restaurants downtown to remind them of the new rules. Right now, he's at a Mexican restaurant, Don Pepe. He tells the owner, Juan Miguel, indoor dining must stop by 3 p.m., but then he tries to soften the blow. Gonzalez tells Miguel he'll try to get some heaters for outdoor dining. Miguel says that sounds good. Back outside on Main Street, Gonzalez, who works for the Firebaugh Police Department, says he wants to make sure businesses operate safely.
Just going into the businesses, seeing everybody wearing masks. I have a good rapport with the business owners and the employees, and it's just one of the things where I try to stay on top of.
He says it's the city's goal to keep residents and business owners up to date on how to mitigate the spread of the virus. And the data shows it's paid off.
When it first started, Fresno County, we were the third highest. And then before you knew it, we started dropping, and right now we're one of the lowest.
In April, the town with just over 8,000 residents went from 0 to 15 cases in a matter of days. That's when city officials came together to create a game plan for how they would reduce the case numbers, Gonzalez says.
We, along with the chief and the city council, we started coming up with protocols. Okay, these are the protocols we're going to set forth in order for our residents to follow, not only our residents, but also people who are traveling through or you're visiting.
Gonzalez says the city has provided business owners with PPE for customers, signs to hang outside that outline COVID safety guidelines, and...
If they were only Spanish-speaking, I would read the whole thing to them, hand over the paperwork, and everything came with a business card.
He says he wants people in the town to feel like they are all in this together. Back at Don Pepe, owner Juan Miguel says that part is true, but there's a much bigger problem than just acquiring PPE.
They give us masks and hand sanitizers, yes, but that doesn't help much. They can have a big round of applause for that, for sure. But what we need now is money.
Miguel says his 20-year-old business is tanking, and it's causing fights between him and his family, who are struggling to decide whether it's worth it to keep the restaurant running.
Of the businesses affected by the pandemic, I think the restaurants have been hit the hardest because we depend on people.
Before Newsom's recent order, the restaurant was able to open at 30% capacity. But even then, Miguel says they were hardly getting any customers.
Out of that, only 10% would come in, and the rest don't come in at all because they're scared of catching the virus.
The winter months have always been tough on local businesses. It's an off-season for farm workers, so they aren't spending as much, Miguel says. And now that he can't serve anyone indoors, Miguel says it's going to be even harder. A few blocks away at Fireball Restaurant, owner Juan Portillo agrees.
The field workers have stopped. Now they're just collecting unemployment, but with just that, they don't have money to go eat at a restaurant, just to pay the bills.
Outside, Veronica Mendoza, a migrant worker and single mother to three kids, says that's true. She says there's no work right now, and she only has money for rent and groceries. Plus, she's concerned about her daughter, who suffers from seizures. Mendoza says she won't risk taking her anywhere that might increase her chance of catching COVID.
It's very difficult for me to take her out. If I do, she's wearing gloves and a mask, and is usually in the parks.
The code enforcement officer, Surf Gonzalez, says he encourages residents and businesses to do what they can to keep themselves safe. But when he has to share bad news, like telling restaurant owners to close indoor dining, it's really tough.
It's really affecting the smaller places.
And he worries with the recent surge in the state, being the bearer of bad news will only get worse. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Mari Bolaños.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. At the start of the pandemic, Avenal State Prison postponed college classes and other programs to prevent inmates from spreading COVID-19 between housing units. Employees, however, can move freely between them. As FM89's Carrie Klein reports, many public health experts, including officials in Kings County, have warned against such movement.
Ed Welker is relatively new to Avenal State Prison. He's been incarcerated there since March, but when he was recently moved to a new dorm on a different yard, he saw a familiar face.
One of the officers that are working right now in the building that I'm in the two-yard, is the regular building officer over on the five-yard where I just came from.
Welker says he and other inmates were shocked to learn that correctional officers, or COs, can work their main shifts and overtime in different parts of the prison, even if one of those is a quarantine area.
We're like, wait a second, if you normally work over there and we know that there's positive cases over there, what the hell are you doing coming over here?
More than 3,300 inmates and staff have tested positive for the virus at Avenal. It's the highest total of any prison in California and possibly the highest in the country. 8 incarcerated men have died. The union that represents COs confirms picking up overtime shifts in different facilities does fall under its contract with the state prison system. In contrast, county public health officials and even the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warn against this practice, arguing that keeping staff in place can help mitigate the spread of the disease. Inmate Ty Tran fears for his health.
They should just work overtime on the same yard, not go to another yard. They'll bring it back over here, and that's how the infection spread from other yards.
The risk may be even greater because a recent report shows many prisons are not following basic safety precautions. California's Office of the Inspector General found staff failed to properly wear masks at 2/3 of the prisons it visited. Social distancing wasn't followed either. Here's Ed Welker again.
They're putting our lives in danger because this had been put out as a potentially deadly disease.
Avenal reported its first case of COVID-19 in mid-May in an employee. Soon after, Kings County Public Health Director Edward Hill tried to get ahead of a prison outbreak.
Yeah, we issued 6 health officer orders.
6 orders to the warden of Avenal, which is overseen by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, or CDCR. They addressed testing and quarantining, and one ordered the prison to keep employees on the same assignment until the outbreak was under control. But CDCR, of course, is a state agency, not a county one.
CDCR's legal counsel sent us a letter stating that we didn't have authority within their fences, that they would follow the recommendations by the California Department of Public Health.
Online guidance from the Department of Public Health doesn't mention anything about modifying staff work assignments. The agency deferred specific questions back to CDCR, which declined an interview for this story. But in a statement, a CDCR representative did say prisons limit staff movement to the extent possible given their labor agreements and that they follow CDC recommendations. For its part, the CDC says minimizing staff movement is essential during the pandemic, and UC San Francisco echoed the guidance in a memo to San Quentin State Prison. All of this is frustrating for Kings County Supervisor Craig Peterson, who says the state tasked the county with protecting public health, but by ignoring the county's health orders, he feels that Avenal isn't cooperating.
You know, when the state's asking us to perform, you would expect that the state would be performing at that same level.
Especially because the state has asked businesses everywhere to scale back due to the virus.
It just didn't sit well with me that, you know, you have, you know, a set of labor decisions impacting a community that has another set of limitations.
In an email statement, the CO's union doesn't deny that they could be vectors for the virus. But whether prison guards have been a factor in Avenal's massive outbreak, incarceree John Walker doesn't fault them for doing their jobs.
You know, there's a lot of pressure on the COs, and I think a lot of them, it wasn't their fault. I think their higher-ups are the ones pressuring them to do these things.
After all, the report from the Office of the Inspector General didn't blame the employees for not wearing their masks properly and not social distancing. It pointed to lax enforcement from administrators. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Avenal isn't the only local prison struggling to contain the pandemic. And unfortunately, prisons are not the only places facing a surge in cases. You just heard our health reporter, Carrie Klein, with that story. And now she's with us for our weekly COVID-19 update to talk a little more about where the pandemic stands around the Valley. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, thanks, Kathleen.
So let's stay on the subject of prisons for a few more minutes. They are so isolated, and right now they're especially cut off from the rest of us. Are those facilities seeing the same fluctuations in COVID-19 cases that we're observing out in the community?
Unfortunately, yes, and maybe surprisingly, but prisons in general in California began to see a surge starting at the end of October, and 10% of all cases in the prison system have been reported in just the last 2 weeks.
And you said Avenal now has the highest number of cases of all California's prisons?
Cumulatively over the course of the entire pandemic, yes. The New York Times tallies COVID cases in prisons across the country, and Avenal has unfortunately been at the top of that list for weeks. However, if you're looking at active outbreaks, like the number of currently infectious cases, you'll find that highest number at a different prison. And also when it comes to fatalities due to COVID-19, Avenal has not been nearly as hard hit as some other facilities. So whereas 8 inmates have died at Avenal, nearly 30 have died at each of San Quentin State Prison in Marin County and California Institution for Men in Chino.
So if Avenal doesn't have the largest current outbreak, which prison does?
Well, right now, it's another prison in Kings County, which seems like it kind of just can't cut a break. There are two other state prisons in Kings County, and they're both in Corcoran. That there's California State Prison Corcoran, which has had nearly 400 cases. And the other one just kind of shot onto the radar recently. It's called the Substance Abuse Treatment Facility. And out of 1,200 cases there, nearly half are currently active. And so I know I've thrown a lot of numbers out during this interview, but there's one more point about this that I want to make. Kings County has a population of around 150,000 people. Its three state prisons hold 11,000 people, far fewer, but almost half of the county's cases are among the incarcerated. So think about that.
That is staggering. So what have the COVID-19 trends looked like more generally across the San Joaquin Valley this week?
Okay, so when we look at cases, daily new reported cases have risen tremendously. They are double what they were 2 weeks ago. In hospitals, the number of patients with COVID have also steadily risen, up another 30% just in the last week. We've still got a ways to go before we hit the hospital capacities that we reached in, late July at that other last big surge, but hospitals are preparing for that. When we look at COVID-related deaths, there's still a lag between rising cases and rising fatalities, thankfully, so there hasn't been a tremendous jump in people dying of COVID just yet. And then when we look at the blueprint for a safer economy, there were huge changes across the whole state this week and the Valley. Other than Mariposa County, which is still in the least restrictive yellow tier, all Valley counties are now in the most restrictive purple tier. In fact, more than 40 counties across the state, equivalent to 94% of the state's population, are all in this purple tier. And you've probably noticed a difference wherever you live. You know, restaurants, gyms, houses of worship, they've all moved indoors, and lots of other businesses with indoor operations probably had to reduce their maximum capacities.
So far, how does this surge right now compare to what we saw over the summer?
So for right now, we are not at the high levels of cases or hospitalizations or deaths that we were seeing during that peak in late July, thank goodness. But health officials at the state level and with Fresno County say cases are rising much more sharply than they were before. That's really concerning. And Kern County health officials in a media call yesterday referred to all of this as an epic mess. But generally, health officials also say they feel a lot more prepared for a surge than they did before. You know, they've been through this before. Hospitals now have surge protocols that have been tested at this point. In Kern County, for example, county supervisors a few months ago set aside $12 million in CARES Act funding to bring on traveling nurses to help staff hospital beds. According to the county, they've only spent $1 or $2 million of that so far, so they've got the resources to take on many more nurses. And then there's also this site in Porterville to take on overflow COVID patients, and it did that over the summer, and it's ready to go again with just 2 days' notice whenever that happens. There are also various convention centers and fairgrounds that can be commissioned for COVID patients as well. One other interesting thing about all this is that we know a lot more about the virus than we did at the last surge, particularly how common hospitalizations are. You know, that can vary everywhere in different places, but it means that counties and hospitals can actually estimate the number of patients that they'll eventually have based on, you know, the case rates in their surrounding counties.
Well, worrying news, but I'm glad to hear that health officials are not panicking. So, Carrie, as always, thank you so much for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last week, Russia negotiated a ceasefire between Armenia and Azerbaijan, ending a six-week war that left thousands dead. The dispute was over the Nagorno-Karabakh, a territory within Azerbaijan's border, but inhabited nearly exclusively by ethnic Armenians, many of whom are now forced to flee their homes, some reportedly burning them to the ground before they leave. To learn more about the conflict and what it means for the future of Armenia, I spoke with Anna Ohanian, a non-resident senior scholar for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Stonehill College. Also joining the discussion is Sergio Laporta, Haig and Isabel Berberian Professor of Armenian Studies and Interim Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at Fresno State. Anna, I'm wondering if you could explain what has been taking place over the last couple of months. What led to this eruption from a geopolitical perspective, and then also from a perspective of the internal politics taking place both within Armenia and Azerbaijan?
Sure. The war has ended. The first war of Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenians and Azerbaijan is ended with a ceasefire in early 90s, negotiated by Russia at the time. So since then, this conflict sometimes would be described, often would be described as a frozen conflict because the level of hostility has gone down. The ceasefire largely was holding. There were no peacekeepers on the ground. So this was self-enforcing. A ceasefire. There were skirmishes on the border. Average 25 per year, on average 25 soldiers would die, which in political science literature is usually described as a low intensity conflict. The dramatic shift started happening, and there was a peace agreement. There was a peace process that was developed to solve the very difficult issues of status of Nagorno-Karabakh. And the peace process negotiation format was under the OSCE Minsk group with France, United States, and Russia as members. And again, over the past, since early 90s, that Minsk group has been working. There have been several points at which the negotiators and Armenians and Azerbaijani leadership came close to a compromise, to finding a solution. But in 2016, there was the war erupted again, 4-day war. After that, there was another war erupted this summer. In both cases, Azerbaijan essentially has been trying to recapture territory under Armenian control. The de facto territory of Nagorno-Karabakh in this period developed its institutions, carried out its elections, but it very much has been supported. Armenia has been the security guarantor for this tiny entity, not so tiny entity. Armenia also did control neighboring surrounding territories occupied, which essentially were described as they're under their Azerbaijani territory, but which Armenia was hoping, was planning to use as negotiation bargaining when the negotiation period would arrive. And over the years, Armenia position as Azerbaijan continued militarization, military buildup, very bellicose rhetoric, especially after President Aliyev came to power, inheriting his seat from his father. So this essentially started this insecurity cycle for Armenians, who then also moved, hardened their position. What you saw over the past over a month and a half, essentially, was a very different kind of escalation. This was not an escalation. This was a very different war because Azerbaijan brought in Turkey to support with all kinds of not only logistics but also drones, mercenaries that Turkey essentially deployed from Syria, where it is already involved in this conflict, as well as Libya. So Syrian mercenaries were dropped into South Caucasus, fighting on the side of Azerbaijanis, and it was really an asymmetric warfare. Very deadly, and considering that there was a negotiation process going on, this militarized approach stands out. As to why this particular, essentially, it was evolving and has been evolving, has been a proxy war if we considered the mercenaries and the Turkish support, and Russia, which has a security alliance with Armenia, not Nagorno-Karabakh, very much stayed on the sidelines, trying to broker a deal, negotiated ceasefires a couple of times, which broke, did not hold. And perhaps we can talk about Russia later. But what is also important is that I do think that looking at this conflict for a while, that 2018 was significant development because Armenia has this velvet revolution. It was a democratic breakthrough, bottom-up, grassroots, nonviolent disobedience campaign, which strengthened, created a democratic dyad with neighboring Georgia. So this strengthened the democratic pole in South Caucasus. This put the pressure on Aliyev, which was a petrostate, unreformed petrostate, hereditary ruler pretty much. And studies show that this would have pressured Azerbaijani society also to democratize. But essentially, Azerbaijan responded very shrewd on the part of the Aliyev, President Aliyev. He pulled in Turkey, increasingly authoritarian state, and with all of the technology, military technology superiority, they really overwhelmed the Armenian forces. There's very little that Armenian side could have done.
Sergio, can you speak to the humanitarian crisis that has emerged as a result of this?
Sure. I would say there are two aspects to the humanitarian crisis. One is obviously the number of civilians who have been killed by the bombing, particularly by the drone attacks on the inhabitants of Karabakh. And now there are also the people who are going to be displaced due to the transfer of territories and the capture of Shushi, what the Azeris called Shusha. The future of these people is still uncertain. We don't know. I haven't been able to find accurate numbers. I haven't heard accurate numbers of how many people will have to move. We've seen dramatic videos of people burning their houses as they leave in tears, praying at the monastery of Dadivant before evacuating. But there will be there is an emerging humanitarian crisis as the question of where these people will go, whether they will go elsewhere within Nagorno-Karabakh or whether they will go to the Republic of Armenia. Neither place is particularly prepared to receive a large amount of refugees, or to Russia as another possibility. So this is a crisis on the ground. I know it's a crisis that the aspiring community now is aware of and will be mobilizing itself to provide as much assistance as it can. But it will take one of the hard things about the conflict now is that in some ways the inhabitants of Nagorno-Karabakh were just recovering from the trauma that had been inflicted upon them during the last war in the 90s with the constant shelling from Shushi onto Stepanakert. The trauma was incredible. Many people had been out there to try and help the population with post-traumatic stress syndrome. They were just coming out of all of that. And now once again, they've been under attack and will have to evacuate their homes and be relocated.
And then can you also speak to the cultural monuments that could potentially be destroyed?
Yes. Now, there are a large amount of churches and monasteries in the area, both in what remains of Nagorno-Karabakh, as in to the territories that have been agreed upon to be ceded to control of Azerbaijan. Dadivank is one of the more famous ones, again, a medieval monastery with a scriptorium. And in Shushi, there's St. Xavier Chazan Chetzot's church that has a lot of spiritual and emotional attachment to the population. We can also speak of other monasteries from the 5th century, such as Amaras. The eventual situation of these places is unknown. I mean, hopefully there are people, there are many petitions going around, and I know a lot of people have been encouraged to sign them to preserve the monumental cultural heritage of the area so that it's not destroyed. What is really making people nervous is that between 1996 and 2006, the Armenian Khachkars in the exclave of Nakhichevan, which was under Azerbaijani control, were systematically destroyed, obliterated. And this was actually caught on video and by satellite. And the Azerbaijani government has denied it, even though it was there. And this has made people nervous that they'll do the same sort of cultural destruction in the areas that they have now captured in Karabakh. And so it's of the utmost importance that every international foundation and cultural heritage institution make sure that these areas are protected and not destroyed, and that restorers and conservators are allowed to go in to make sure that they will be allowed to stand and not even suffer from neglect. I know at the moment at Dadivank, there are Russian peacekeeping soldiers that are supposedly protecting the monks who have been allowed to stay there and to continue to worship. So maybe that will be a way forward, at least in the short term. But we will need some long-term protections for all of these sites in the areas that have been captured.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. You've just heard from Sergio Laporta, professor of Armenian Studies at Fresno State. We're also talking with Anna Ohanian, who is a professor of international relations at Stonehill College. Anna, where does Armenia go from here?
Well, the ceasefire agreement that was negotiated by Russia, which essentially the military victory of Azerbaijan was pretty overwhelming, and this essentially was forced on Armenia. There's very little Armenia could do. But in this agreement, the status, the most contentious issue, the status of Nagorno-Karabakh is not mentioned. So there's really, and it is important to note that since Nagorno-Karabakh received some stability with the end of the first Nagorno-Karabakh war, Nagorno-Karabakh population in Nagorno-Karabakh actually organized elections, built a parliament, so had worked to build these democratic institutions from the ground up. So the status of Nagorno-Karabakh is crucially, critically important moving forward. For Armenia itself, this protecting, essentially guaranteeing, supporting in the political status, trying to get a political status for Nagorno-Karabakh will remain on the agenda, absolutely. So at the same time, Armenia will now engage with Azerbaijan and Russia, hopefully by bringing in the French and the Americans as part of the OSCE Minsk group in order to start negotiating a more meaningful, more sustainable settlement, to arrive at a more sustainable settlement, which should include the status. because of Nagorno-Karabakh, because of this vast ambiguities in the agreement, as well as the lack of clarity as to whether or not Europeans, OSCE and Minsk group will come in. Looks like they will be coming in, reintegrating, but it's unclear whether they will have the financial or the political capital in really building a peace process that will consider, reflect the interests of the Armenian community in Nagorno-Karabakh. That remains unclear, but hugely important for Armenia. Domestically for Armenia, now Nagorno-Karabakh will become the question, the peace process will become a continuous factor that will make it very difficult for Armenia to consolidate its very fragile democracy that it now has succeeded to build in Russia's authoritarian orbit. So this is of huge concern. There are two essentially stories to follow. One is what will happen to Nagorno-Karabakh status, what type of peace process will be deployed, rebuilt in this process, whether Europeans will engage. And number two, what will the impact be of much stronger Russian presence in the South Caucasus and now Turkey's unrepentant genocidal power, Turkey wedged more firmly in Azerbaijan. These two powers, authoritarian powers, one providing for security, Russians did end the violence. It's very hugely important. It stopped the bleeding. But at the same time, Russians don't do peace building. They do provide security. So the question as to how the presence of these two factors will have on democratic consolidation in Armenia remains is a stressor, I should say. I am hopeful that because the way Armenia's Velvet Revolution emerged, it was bottom-up, nonviolent, led by civic groups, studies show that these types of democratic breakthroughs are more likely to consolidate. So that definitely bodes well for Armenia. But there's a huge backlash against Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, who led the revolution. There's backlash now against him for accepting these very painful concessions imposed on Armenia in this war. So that is something to watch. It is important to highlight that the political protest in Armenia against the Pashinyan government, some of which is led by the forces that were left out from that they could not get a seat in Armenia's democratic parliament. So these are, I refer to them as authoritarian reserves. Some of it is that, so it's not new. But the presence of this unresolved, essentially lack of clarity for Nagorno-Karabakh, the war, provides a very convenient sort of cover for all of these authoritarian forces to reemerge. So democratic institutions, we're watching to see whether they will hold, whether Armenia's new democracy, young democracy, can manage this crisis constitutionally through its institutions moving forward. And Armenia has demonstrated already once that it can produce a democratic breakthrough in Russia's authoritarian orbit. And it's an issue that now Belarus is struggling with, but Moldova, Kyrgyzstan, Ukraine, these are all countries that are learning to build democracy while living with Russia. So that is the challenge. I think Armenians have done it already since 2018. We just have to watch to make sure that these two issues, security, that Armenia does not have to choose between security provided by the Russians versus democracy, democratic consolidation that it has undertaken.
And I just want to say this because I think it'll be of interest to, you know, the people who are listening here in the Valley, since we do have such a large diasporan community, that one of the more notable aspects that we've seen of the conflict is the response that it has elicited, not just in Armenia, but also in the diaspora, and that there have been protests throughout, I would say, throughout the world and Armenian communities throughout the world, where the communities have become now engaged once again with what is going on in Armenia and with Artsakh. And if there is a positive aspect to this, which it's hard to call it that, but it has sort of awoken the Armenian diaspora again to realize that they can't just take the Republic of Armenia or Nagorno-Karabakh for granted. And they do have a role to play in the future of how this conflict unfolds. They need to be able to maintain pressure on various governments, not just Russia, but also the United States and France and in Europe, as well as to make sure that international organizations are involved and on the ground in protecting the Armenian sites that have now fallen under Azerbaijani control. So their voices have been heard. They're very active on social media, and they need to continue to be active in arguing for the rights of the Armenians in the region.
Ana Ohanya and Sergio Laporta, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The events of 2020 have been challenging for journalists to cover. The stories that have dominated the news cycle, from the election to wildfires, and of course the pandemic, are all being interpreted by audiences through increasingly divided lenses. To help us think through what this moment has to say about who we are and where we're headed, I spoke with journalist and author Farai Chidea. You may know her from her work with NPR as an ABC News analyst, a contributor to 538, or from her latest project, the podcast Our Body Politic, which explores how women of color experience and shape politics. Chidea began by sharing her thoughts on objectivity in journalism.
I was never the biggest fan of it. What I'm a fan of, and I've written about this, is fairness. So when I go and interview someone who's an active white supremacist, as I have face-to-face more than once, and many other times, you know, through the phone or running conversations and DMs on Twitter, I am not objective about their ideology. Their ideology has been used to kill people throughout many centuries of history up to the present day. So what am I going to be objective about? Objectively, they support an ideology that kills Black and Brown people, but I have all sorts of feelings about that. However, those feelings do not put me in a position as a reporter where I seek to demonize them or to portray them in ways that are inaccurate. I have been able to have very deep conversations with white supremacists and nationalists for this reason, because I'm just like, yeah, I don't agree with you, but, you know, like, let's chop it up. Tell me why you believe what you believe. And tell me also, like, tell me about your feelings. Like, I find my most recent conversations have focused a lot on things like the anxiety and depression that many white young men who join white nationalist movements feel. That does not excuse them turning to this ideology as a way to make themselves feel powerful, but it helps me understand it. It helps people who I write for or broadcast for understand. So I think it's quite possible to not be objective in the sense of floating on a godlike cloud where you have no feelings, no history, no color, because the only people who've been allowed to float on that cloud are essentially white men. No one assumes that reporters of color are objective. And even if objectivity were the goal, the bias around who is considered objective is a huge problem. For me, I would much rather stand on the plank of fairness. I am fair to people I interview. I do not demonize them. I do not take their words out of context. I spend as much time as I possibly can with them under the circumstances to really get a 360 view of who they are in the context, preferably before COVID, in a physical context, so that I could see them around their friends and their neighbors and at their church, et cetera. So I think that essentially objectivity has long been a construct that said that if you are like the people who are publishing you or putting you on air and various attributes around race, class, gender, et cetera, match up, then you're objective. And if those attributes don't match up, then you have an opinion. And really, so much of journalism has been defined by that, where people who are, you know, air quote, objective journalists were the ones who did horrible coverage about the Central Park Five. People who were, quote, objective journalists were the ones who termed the children born to women using crack, crack babies, when actually scientifically we know now there were not the deleterious effects. There were kids whose parents used crack who turned out just fine. And the ones who didn't, it was because of parental neglect or other reasons. It's not like you're saying, well, there's nothing bad about using crack while you're having a pregnancy. But what you need to do is match up the stories from the crack era and the stories about white women from the opioids era. Both people are using drugs. Some are demonized, some are not. That's what objective journalism has done. And so I stand on the plank of fairness, and I think that lived experience, my lived experience of growing up, not by any means poor, but with a certain degree of financial insecurity, has made me a better reporter because I try to understand class and income. And I don't make assumptions that everyone is middle class or that the American middle class spans everyone from people who make $45,000 a year to $500,000 a year.
Right, right.
You know?
Right. Well, let's dive into some of the conversations and some of the reporting that you've done. And I specifically want to talk about politics. You're someone who has covered every election since 1996. Mm-hmm. This is a rather vague question, purposely so, but as you reflect back on this election, what do you think will be some of the key lessons learned?
Oh boy. Well, I think one of the key lessons I've learned is that it's really hard for the media to learn lessons. It's like, oh, in 2016, we over-relied on polls. We're not going to do that again.
We did it again.
Yep, did it again. It's like, wow, in 2016, we really underestimated the impact of racial resentment on the election. We won't do that again. You know?
Yeah. So, yeah.
So I think that one of my lessons learned is that lessons are hard to learn for the journalism industry. But in terms of the broader question of the American public, I think that a lesson that we are still learning, that I hope we learn, is that culture war rules are different from typical rules. Meaning, in a culture war era, which we're in, many people will believe whatever people who espouse their ideology tell them to believe. And I deliberately am not putting this on one political party, although disinformation is not evenly parceled out across the ideological spectrum. It is weighted to the right. And I will say that unapologetically, backed up by tons of research. But there's something called confirmation bias, which is that just kind of naturally human beings seek out information that reassures us about what we already believe. And I deal with that. I have been someone who's had to check my own confirmation bias. And I read pretty expansively, including white supremacist websites and far right wing media and, you know, democratic socialist media, and occasionally even, you know, like the English versions of the state papers of Russia and China or whatever. Like, I want to know what people are saying. I don't have to believe all of it. And it's a good reality check for me to really see the wide ranging types of information out there. But I think what we have to learn is that human beings in a polarized time like this pretty much have pack logic. It's like, I'm going to run with my pack, and whatever people say in my pack, I'm going to run with. So wearing masks doesn't matter. Okay, if your pack is running with that. Now we're seeing this massive COVID spike that was completely predictable. And we're seeing governors of states that refuse to espouse wearing masks for political reasons have to backtrack belatedly to science. But the reason that they didn't espouse it was not really about anything empirical, even about the fear of job loss. It was running with the pack. And so I think that what we need to learn from this is that, you know, something I've been saying a lot recently is you can't fact check a culture war. I mean, you can, but it's just not that useful. It's not going to change minds. It's not going to persuade people. What does help is doing journalism about why people espouse their beliefs and getting down to really a deeper level of human understanding, without which we are going to be in for a rough several years. And we just might be, because I'm not sure that we are learning that lesson.
I spend a lot of time thinking about media literacy. I spend a lot of time thinking about the demands that the internet has put on consumers of information to be mindful of its credibility. And it just seems to me that there isn't much desire amongst the public to put in that hard work to do what you do, to expand the basis of where you're getting your information from. Do you see any, where will we hit a tipping point at which point this actually becomes important to the American public?
So I think that the tipping point comes really through one of two things. One is transformational leadership, which does not mean top-down leadership. It could mean a widely dispersed group of community leaders basically say, we've got to stop this before we all die. And that could happen in places all over the country. Or we do die, and I don't just mean from COVID, I mean from racial violence, et cetera, and then we say, let's stop this. Unfortunately, history shows that we often take path number two. And Omar Wasso, who's a professor of political science at Princeton, does amazing research on how essentially during the civil rights era, when white Americans saw Black people being brutalized and chewed up by dogs and sprayed with water cannons and not resisting, white Americans in the regions where that was happening and nationally began to embrace the cause of civil rights. But if Black people resisted in any way, they rejected the cause of civil rights. So essentially, the way that Wasso frames it is that seeing people suffer and die without any kind of active resistance is what changes minds. That's a pretty awful lesson to learn from history. And I also don't think it will happen again. I don't think one of the things we talked about on Our Body Politic is Black Americans have been buying guns at a much higher clip than previously for self-protection. Previously, the idea of buying guns for self-protection in the home was kind of a mainly white, mainly right, meaning politically right, NRA type endeavor. There's been a high increase in people who consider themselves politically progressive buying guns and people who are non-white buying guns. I think people are essentially preparing for a civil war. I hope it doesn't happen, but I'm not going to ignore evidence like that. I mean, someone I know who's an extremely wealthy investor who's been tracking this as, you know, work to try to de-escalate says that ammunition sales are up 3 times over where they were last year. And so I am hoping that we pull ourselves back from the brink through essentially internal community-based diplomacy, but I'm also not banking on that happening.
What you just said made me think about the connection between economic instability and some of the divisiveness that we're experiencing in America right now. So before we wrap up, I would like to talk a little bit about economics. You wrote a book a few years back called The Episodic Career about how to navigate this rapidly evolving workplace and economy. And given the moment that we find ourselves in now as a result of the pandemic and the recession, what are your thoughts about the future of the workplace?
Well, I do think that we are likely to be in a K-shaped recovery from the COVID economic declines, meaning the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer. So we're already seeing that the market has yielded some very handsome returns for investors. Bitcoin is up, et cetera. And by and large, wealthy white collar workers have done just fine. People who work in the service industry and many other people who aren't making a lot of money have been devastated. Of all of the race and gender groups, the group that has taken the hardest hit appears to be Latinas. And, you know, when you look at the September unemployment numbers, there was like 3/4 of the unemployment was women. And of them, Latinas were not only the largest group proportionally, but the largest group of women. And so I was talking to a white male, upper middle class friend of mine the other day, and he was like, yeah, I was talking to this friend, and he was like, yeah, everything's fine with the economy. And I said, I don't think so. And I was like, yeah, I bet your friend, similarly to you, is a well-off white man. And he was like, oh yeah, he's rich. And I was like, well, here's some stats, you know? And so I don't know exactly what's going to come of the long run, but I think that, you know, right now, all of the stimulus that could be provided by the government is due to run out. There's a lot of log jams on Capitol Hill. I do suspect that we'll see a lot of desperation that will intensify if we don't act. You know, people who are economically desperate, some of them are psychologically able to be just fine in the sense that they are so deeply resilient that they can weather it. And some people lash out in anger at others, and some people self-destruct. So we've seen, even as people have less money, massive spikes in purchases of opioids because people are depressed. And so if you are already struggling economically and then in that pick up an opioid habit, that's a recipe for complete financial disaster as well as possibly death. And so I know that I'm sounding like a complete Debbie Downer here. So what I would say the upside is that I've also seen people finding new ways to reach that level of resiliency and to prioritize self-care and family. And the pandemic has been a sorting hat. And some of us are doubling down on love and self-care and self-preservation, and others are self-destructing. And that's not even a moral judgment, it's just a fact. And so part of the issue is, what are the external circumstances that we can control collectively through government, through community, that give people the best chance to live the best life? I think that's really the struggle that we face as a society. Like, I give to mutual aid societies. I've made as many financial contributions earlier this year as I could, and I'm going to take a look at my budget and see what else I can do. But, you know, like, my little oar isn't going to get the boat to shore, but I can do what I can. And feeling a sense of engagement rather than defeat is really important. So whatever people can do to center themselves, it should not be up to you just having a good attitude to get through this, but it certainly can't hurt to center yourself in some kind of practice of self-compassion, joy, spirituality, if that's your thing, meditation, if that's your thing, exercise, if that's your thing. We're all going to have to dig deep to be the best self we can be under these circumstances.
Well, Farai Chidea, host and creator of the podcast, Our Body Politic, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Kathleen. Really appreciate it.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.